Greg Jonas.
3 points. I came into this discussion yesterday, you know, thinking that this project was worth doing. Despite a fairly broad, sweeping conversation without clear resolution on any aspect of it, I'm even more convinced this is worth doing. It is so fundamental to, I think, a regulatory endeavor of any type to define who the customer is and what we're trying to do and what the indicators are of quality, that I think regardless of whether the PCAOB ultimately decides that firms should report against specific measures, there's a lot of benefits that will come just from the discipline of having thought this through, and it will serve, you know, your inspection program, your standard setting, and your other endeavors well, regardless of the outcome of this exercise. Yesterday, my second point is I argued that I thought it was worth taking the time to define quality, and I believe even more so now that I recognize that even this group, who's pretty close to the profession, doesn't have anywhere near a similar view about what we're trying to accomplish and for who. I don't lament that. I'm not being critical with that statement. I'm just observing it. It just tells me that we got to double down this bet and take the time to define quality. I looked on the internet last night, and the most common definition of quality seems to be meeting customers' needs continuously, which means we got to define who the customer is, what their needs are, and how our product goes about meeting those needs. And then I think our quality measures should be directly referenced to the product. I also noticed in some internet reading that there's clearly two ways you can go about measuring quality. There are process measures, and there are product measures. And I'm in the product camp, at least as far as trying to excite people about what we're trying to achieve here. For example, an auto company could describe their quality measure as compliance with their Six Sigma process. Not very exciting, but it can be done that way. Another way to do it is to define, well, here are the attributes of the automobile I'm trying to create. You know, it's pollution statistics, defects per car, acceleration, gas mileage, reliability, the kinds of things we know and love. You can relate to that more, at least I can. So I would encourage us to, when we get to defining quality, do it in terms of the product and the output measure rather than a process orientation. I just think it's more exciting. And then finally, I'd like to report that throughout the day yesterday, Richard Fleck got a lot smarter in my mind. When he initially reported in the morning, I was left wondering why he couldn't have gone further with his group, and I kind of, you know, was left thinking, well, the poor Brits just can't, you know, make the kind of progress that we're capable of. And by the end of the day, I was admiring the Brits considerably for their wisdom in how he decided to both be making progress, gathering intelligence, but not doing it in a way that put the cart before the horse. And so I would encourage the board to maybe embrace this notion that Richard told us about yesterday, which is, within the terms of a broad framework, asking the firms to report on their vision of quality and their measures, and kind of a self-reporting through their eyes might be a good, very good first step that maybe down the road we can more standardize this thing, but standardization at the front end might be a mistake.
Great, thanks for those comments. Lynn Turner.
Marty, I just want to cover something that's been discussed about with respect to the small firms versus the large firms. In the Treasury Committee report, it did make a cut when it came to the annual report of the firms and whether or not the small firms would need to provide audited financial statements or not. But when it came to quality control factors, there is intentionally, I believe, no such cut put into the recommendation, that the audit quality control factors would be no different for a small firm versus a big firm, and there is no scalability notion in there for that whatsoever. And in fact, some small firms told us they thought they'd compete very nicely on the quality control factors, and hence no cut. I do think that if a small firm's going to make the decision to come into this arena, they want to compete with the big four, then they need to compete with the big four. And that it's not necessarily a good idea to say come in and compete, but then turn around and give them advantages that you wouldn't also turn around and give big firms at the same time. It's up to the small firm as to whether or not they want to play in the public arena or not. But when they play in the public arena, I think they need to understand they take on very much so a public interest type notion.
Great. Thank you, Lynn. Randy Futchall?
Thank you, Marty. I'm sorry that I missed the session yesterday, but on the issue of comparability among firms and scalability to audit firms of all sizes, I'm struck by, you know, the idea is quality control over one's audit services, in some ways drawing a parallel to, you know, management assertions with respect to internal control over financial reporting. The SEC guidance there was to not be overly prescriptive, to focus on qualitative, not quantitative, which I've heard come up in each of the groups. And the idea is the objective is absolutely the same of an organization, whether internal control over financial reporting or quality control over one's audit services. So a flexible, tailored approach, knowing that the objective is the same at the end of the day, seems to me to make a lot of sense rather than to get too much prescription, too much detail.
Well, I'm sure Sam missed your input yesterday at the session where he had a minority of auditors, so it's...
I doubt that he missed me at all.
Next, we'll hear from Barbara Roper.
You know, I have to say, I started this discussion yesterday thinking we had a fairly simple and elegant idea, which is that there are certain things you can measure that could cause firms to behave in ways that improve audit quality. That we're not purporting to measure some vague concept of audit quality, but we're trying to measure conduct that we believe will promote audit quality. And the more I've heard the direction that this debate seems to be going, this discussion seems to be going, the less convinced I am, frankly, that we're going to come out of here with something that is beneficial. I mean, I think the notion that we would sort of define audit quality and then say we're measuring audit quality and then put out some measure there that purports to be a measure of audit quality is a disaster, because it won't be true. And you can't measure, you know, in some sort of meaningful way this sort of vague concept of audit quality. And I think, you know, I would really stress the importance of getting back to that original, fairly simple, elegant notion that we identify some things that we believe will promote quality audits and measure them and get away from the notion that we are developing a measurement of audit quality.
Thank you. Bob Tirola.
I wanted to reinforce what Barbara just said and what Greg said earlier. I see so many unintended consequences, possible unintended consequences, that I just want to raise some caution. First of all, activity-based measures could be very misleading and uninformative. Just as an example, I'll give you two examples. Same company, two different auditors. One might approach it with a lot of human resources, and one might approach it with a lot of technology. So an hours-based metric could be misleading there. Another example, same auditor, but the company has a strong finance function and internal audit function, and or doesn't. Totally different metrics could develop from auditing that company, each of which would be appropriate in the circumstances, and we wouldn't be able to determine from those statistics whether or not the differences were quality related. So I caution on activity-based measures. I think that this will by necessity have to be more qualitative than quantitative, and I think that's where the challenge lies.
Thanks, Bob. Ted, did you have a comment? Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on a couple of comments earlier and maybe just to address a little bit what Barbara said. First, to Lynn's comments, I think that issue falls under the broad category of unintended consequences. We did touch on that topic. I think there's full respect of the fact that any time that you have a metric, a measure, whether it's quantitative or qualitative, there's all kinds of behavior drivers that are associated with that, and we need to think those through. That's probably an area where the SAG, as well as lots of other constituencies, can help a great deal. But this will, I think this will end up being a cost-benefit analysis in that, you know, we want the benefits of these measures to outweigh what the potential unintended consequences are, and that perhaps, in my mind anyway, this is why our group tended to like a sort of multi-factor or compartmentalized type of measures, because you don't, you know, you sort of spread out those drivers. In regards to the goal here, I think that while we all should have a lot of respect for the difficulty of this, if we stop with sort of simple input-based measures, we're leaving a lot of potential value on the table. And that from an investor standpoint, some type of, you know, what may end up being complex, but output-based measures over long periods of time of audit quality have the most potential to really impact the industry and what, in my opinion, is the ultimate user. I think the customer, from my perspective, is mostly the investment community. I mean, there's other sort of aspects of that. But an output-based, some input or some perspective to an output-based type of measure is going to be necessary here. And I realize that's very, very complex, but I think that we should keep that on the table.
Thank you. Joe Carcello.
Yeah, in listening to the conversation this morning, there seems to be a number of people suggesting that we may want to pursue a voluntary approach to firm reporting on this issue. And, you know, certainly worth thinking about. There's certainly some merit to that. But I think we should also have some cautions thrown up. The first caution is we tried that approach with investment banks with disastrous consequences. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of that outcome. Secondly, if we look at what we're seeing in the UK, Richard and I talked at some length last night, and at least in year one of their reporting, and you know, in fairness to the UK, I think there's hope that it will improve significantly over time. But if we look at year one, I have one of the firm's reports in front of me, and I won't embarrass the firm. But let me just give you a flavor of what they're reporting. Increase in profit, growth in revenue, size of the firm in Europe, whether their clients are satisfied, but no indication of who the client is. That could be the CEO or the CFO. Percentage of applications for flexible working arrangements accepted. Percentage of the people who work for the firm that are proud to work there. These are the kinds of metrics that they're reporting on page one. Then I went to page 12 of their report, where they talk about their audit practice, and they have about 16 measures. I won't bore you with the details, but it wasn't didn't give me a warm and fuzzy as I read these 16. I wouldn't say these mapped into audit quality. They were essentially points of pride of the firm, of how well the firm was doing from a business perspective. And so I think we need to be very careful about a purely voluntary approach, unless there's going to be very, very vigorous oversight of to what's reported as part of that voluntary approach. Now, that could work with vigorous oversight, I think, and I think that's what Richard would probably say. But without that vigorous oversight, I think it's likely to fail. And then let me second what Ted just said. I think output approaches are, at the end of the day, what investors care about. And I agree with also with Greg. That's what matters to people. You start talking a lot about process, not that that doesn't matter, but what, at the end of the day, what matters is output. And I think it also deals, Sam, with your concern about scalability. Because how you get there may look very different for KPMG or PwC than it does for a smaller firm. But at the end of the day, if you're doing public company audits, things that matter to people are low levels of restatement, low levels of fraud, compliance with professional standards. That's what matters to users. And I don't care how you get there. That's kind of irrelevant to me. But you better get there when you're finished, regardless of the size of the firm.
Thank you, Joe. Lynn Turner? Well, Richard, I think you've got two things to respond to. First, I wondered if you wanted to refute Greg Jonas's comments about your growing intelligence. And secondly, I guess wanted to see if you wanted to respond to that, but also be interested to hear from you how you think this debate is similar or not to how the debate evolved in your discussions in the FRC. So I think there's a couple of things we might want to hear from you on.
Thank you, Martin. Let me say that I've really appreciated Greg's comments, and it reminded me of the story of the son who had treated his father when he was 16 and thought he was a complete village idiot. And when asked about whether he still thought that, he thought at the age of 21, he said, well, you know, it's quite extraordinary. He's learned an awful lot in the last 5 years. And I feel it's sort of in that camp. Let me answer the comment, if I may, to Joe just quickly. You're, of course, right that if you look at what you've seen so far, it doesn't achieve the purpose. That is an amalgam of the annual reports that the firms were producing the last 4 or 5 years, and and done voluntarily last year before this was, before either the transparency report or the paper we produced came into effect. And secondly, the reason we have the audit quality framework is to prevent people thinking that they can make up their own metrics and their own subject matter as being the things that are going to be the things they comment on. We've actually listed, however many it is, under four categories, 15 or 20 areas which we expect them to report on. So I think it's not quite as voluntary as your comment might have implied. And as I think I've made clear, we've indicated that if the firms don't report on those, then they will be reporting on those. So I think the voluntariness is a little illusionary, the mandatoriness is a little less illusionary than you indicated. Marty, to your question, effectively, what's my reaction to this discussion? Quite a sense of deja vu. The reality is that we went through a very similar, very wide-ranging, discussion that seemed to be all over the place with lots of views which didn't really come together. And that's not to be discourteous to anybody's comments or contribution at all. But things like quality are very difficult to define, like beauty. And people come at it from different ways and find that difficult. There are some very strongly held and very understandable views on both sides of the Atlantic about the merits of looking at the outputs as being what it's all about. But actually, I personally would share that, but those are also difficult things to do and to do well, because you run the risk that the unseen, other thing, which is what you actually want to happen, is immeasurable, because what you actually are only able to measure is that which you see, i.e. restatements, disclosed frauds and so forth. But what you don't see is the unreported. And one of the great frustrations is that a very well done audit produces a clean audit opinion, advice to management which solves the problem, And the one thing management don't do is go and say on the annual report, and we want to express our thanks to the auditors for finding 3 Fords in Indonesia and 5 in India, because that's not what they want to tell the world about. So a measure of outputs is quite difficult if many of them end up by being confidential. The second comment, I think, is that I think you've hit upon the point which is so important, which is the contact, to make sure there's a proper connection between what you're trying to do and the achievement of audit quality. As we went through our group, discussed at our group, there were many things that on face value looked like they were natural drivers of audit quality, until you thought about how people might use those drivers not as effectively for audit quality, so they actually became detrimental. Let me give you an example. If you measure simply restatements, do you run the risk that some audit partners, when they get to something that's on the margin, are actually going to call it negatively, i.e. we don't need to restate, rather than we do need to restate, knowing that restatements may be negatively read by the marketplace? I'm not saying that that's going to happen all the time. Of course I'm not, and I absolutely don't want to impugn the integrity of the auditors concerned. But the fact of the matter is, you have to ask the question, how could a measure be used negatively? I think Robert raised the same sort of point. How could it drive to the wrong effect? And so the sense of deja vu was very considerable. The fact that it takes time to work through these things to find something that you're comfortable with was very much what happened to us. And I've found it, I have to say, an extremely interesting discussion to listen to. I hope to participate a little bit in. And I must admit, I will be very interested to see how you end up by taking it forward. I shall follow it with not quite bated breath, but very, very considerable interest.
Well, we appreciate your participation and commentary. Thank you, and we'll keep you posted as we move along on this. Lynn Turner, thank you for giving up the floor to Richard, and it's yours.
In setting quality standards, back to the days when I was in a manufacturing company, we would come up with a new product and then put it out, and of course we had the ISO-type standards, which were built around measuring quality of the process, and those never did turn out to be very good, because you could have a great process and a lousy product and it wouldn't recognize it. I think we also found that subjective type standards never did work very well either. I really think you've got to, if you're going to actually measure quality and get people focused on it, you actually have to come up with some objective standards. I just don't think in industry qualitative factors have ever worked and got the product to where it needs to be. The other thing, though, back to the point of Richard getting smarter in just an afternoon, I think this is, as I hear people talk about it, it's like we'll come out with a standard and then that'll be the standard. I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case here. I think this will be an instance of where you want to come out with the best product that you can get out of the starting gate with. But I also think you'll find over time that you probably missed on some of those items, just like you miss in a manufacturing process. You start out with the product, and then as you start rolling it down the manufacturing line, you find there's things you didn't think about, and you need to revise those quality control standards. So I would hope that as the board does this, one, they try to get the best product they can initially, but then they don't view it as, we don't have to come back and look at that for some point in time. I think it's almost something that has to be continuously looked at and evaluated each year. And as someone pointed out, you got the inspection process that can be very advantageous in accomplishing that. So I think all that thought process needs to roll in this, and you certainly need to understand firms do change over time too, and the profession has changed over time. And as those things change, these quality control factors will probably have to revise and change with those as well.
Thank you, Lynn. Ted White?
I was just going to suggest that there may be some examples as you start to research this process a little bit more from other industries that have undertaken, you know, very long processes to try to define and measure quality, and one that comes to mind is healthcare. That you know, there are some similarities in the difficulty of how you measure it and the inputs and all of that, and I know that the industry's done a lot of work on it. And there's probably some examples there, so maybe take a little time and reach out to some other industries. Peggy may have some background on that. I don't know. I don't want to put you on the spot. Sorry, bud.
But nonetheless, I did.
Sorry.
Peggy will take up that challenge in a few moments, I'm sure. Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Just 2 points. One, as Ted already indicated, though there's a lot of difficulties in developing in this project and developing these indicators, I think it is pretty clear that there is, as Ted indicated, significant support from the ultimate customers of audited financial statements for this project. So I would encourage the PCOB to go ahead, develop what they think would be a good definition of audit quality and what they think are the appropriate indicators, and get it out for comment and let us respond to that. Second, in doing that, the council has, we have a number of policies that we've developed over the years related to external auditors. Looking at those policies, I think some of them and many of them are directly related to what our membership believed are linked to improving audit quality. So I would encourage the PCOB to take a look at our policies and the policies of other investor groups relating to the external audit, because I think some metrics will naturally fall out from those policies. And as I said, those policies, many of which were based on an idea that those policies would improve audit quality. Thank you.
Thank you. Galen Hansen.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on some of the comments about the smaller firms, and Lynn is right. There wasn't a cut for scalability on these metrics. The one thing that struck me when this all came out in the hearings, and my initial reaction was, this is great. You know, for small firms, they've been saying for years that they can compete on some engagements with the larger firms, and this is an opportunity for them to step forward and try to demonstrate that. And so from that perspective, I don't think that this should be in any sense an area that would be assumed to be something that would run counter for that. I know in my firm we would welcome this. In fact, and I don't, we've been talking about the voluntarism side of it, and I think that over time, as has been previously said, this will evolve, and in some cases I think firms may step forward and want to participate to improve the, not only improve the metrics, but in with the smaller firms, and I'm talking about second tier and even local practices, they may want to voluntarily make available some of the financial statement type of information. I know our firm would. I think this is a transparency issue. We're now in a regulated industry, and investors and particularly audit committee chairs and audit committees are entitled to this type of information in terms of the decisions that they need to make in terms of hiring their audit firm and continuing with them after that first year. I agree with Greg Jonas that the issue of who is your audience is important. But I think, you know, that is, while it's primarily the investors, the audit committee and the audit committee chairs absolutely have to have this type of information.
On the issue of who is the audience, I've heard some feedback that investors need to know a lot of information that they don't have any. They don't have access to it. But certainly in the group that I sat in yesterday, which was a group that was considering this from an issuer's perspective, and I wonder, Chuck, if you want to or anybody else talk about this. I know in your comments you felt that the audit committee members today have the ability to find out about the audit quality of their engagement by digging into asking the right questions from their firm about staff mix, about industry experience of the staff, about restatements within the firm, what the firm is getting in both Part 1 and Part 2 of the report, and other things like that, that issuers felt they had a lot of information and they could get it, or audit committee members could get it if they wanted to and didn't really need a lot of comparative information from other firms. Do you want to comment on that, or do other audit committee members here want to comment on, is their need different than the need of what investors might have?
Well, as we talked, we felt it was important to distinguish between information that the audit committee needed and what investors needed, in part because I think the roles of the two parties are different. The audit committee is charged with the oversight of the independent auditor. Investors aren't. And so if we had a concern, it was whether or not there was any consistency among audit committees in asking for information, or even knowing that they should and could ask for it, because sometimes perhaps the audit firms would be, if not reluctant, maybe a little, would prefer to not provide some of the information. But frankly, I've never had any difficulties getting the information that I asked for and digging into these quality issues and performance issues of the firm at both the engagement level and at the firm-wide level, but we do think that there's a need for some guidance to audit committees so we can sort of improve the overall performance of the audit committee. I know in our group, some people felt that. Tell me what you, the audit committee, use to make your decision and share it with investors. I don't know that that's practical. I'm not sure it's desirable, and I'm not sure that most investors really want that level of information. I mean, if we were going to ask the investors to do the audit committee's job, I think that's a broader mandate than I think you want to walk into.
Thank you. Bob Tarola.
I just wanted to build on Lynn's manufacturing analogy for a moment. You might want to look at this from the opposite. That is, what is the cost or what are indicators of poor quality as opposed to defining quality? In the manufacturing world, we have rework, we have product liability costs, we have all that. In the auditing world, it seems to me you have similar things. You have some have mentioned restatements, but you also have litigation costs, you have settlements, you have defense costs, you have investigations, you have all those elements that that could be indicators of poor quality. So you might want to look at it from that point of view as well.
Thank you. Larry Salva.
Yeah, I'd like to make the observation that in terms of the appropriate or difference in appropriate measures being different. In my opinion, the ultimate customer is the investor, and if they're going to be asked to ratify a decision of a group which is effectively operating as their agent in engaging a firm to produce to provide a service that they are the consumer of, that the agent may need some more specific information about the team that will be performing the audit, the engagement specifics of that team. The audit committee actually will interact directly with the partner and the team, so they're going to be much more focused on metrics that are specific to the service being provided for their ultimate customer. When the customer ratifies the selection of the auditor, at least currently, they likely do not know the identity of the partner that will be performing the service. So they're really only being asked to ratify the firm, the selection of the firm, and they're relying on their agent to make all the decisions about the detailed audit plan, et cetera. So it would seem to me that those metrics are going to be necessarily different because of the different decisions that the two parties have to make.
Thank you. Joe Carcello.
Yeah, I want to respond, Marty, to the interchange between you and Chuck about whether audit committees generally are able to get the information they need. And I think we need to step back from that and ask, as we did yesterday in our breakout group, do some audit committees even know what information they should want? And I don't think you can use Chuck as the typical audit committee member. It's an audit partner, a CFO, an audit committee chair of a very, very large public company. He's not the typical audit committee member. And so there's a lot of audit committees who don't have someone on the group who have anywhere near his kind of background. And I think often they don't know what they need. And even if they do know what they need, they don't have the sophistication that someone like a Chuck or a Mike Cook or someone like that would have to be able to drive the information that they may want. By providing indicators of audit quality, or at least discussions of what they should be, I think you help audit committees as to the information they should pursue and probably strengthen their bargaining position in getting that information.
I think that's a good point. I think Chuck did make the additional point that that probably some audit committees need guidance and training to ask the right questions to get at the information, but they could get there if they had the right knowledge base and the right questions to ask. But thank you for the clarifying points. Lynn?
To the points Chuck was making about the ratification, I actually sit on both sides of this table, chairing the audit committee of a public entity and then also chairing the shareholder proxy voting committee of the board of a large institutional investors. So I do think that there is, as Chuck said, there's the information an audit committee needs to go through over the course of the year to oversee the audit process and then decide whether or not to say this is the auditor that we want to submit to our shareholders again. But then when the shareholders, and I think it's good then to provide information on that process to the shareholders so they can make an informed vote. Right now, our audit committee reports are basically drafted by a bunch of attorneys. And
a little bit too difficult for accountants, is it?
I will let those reports stand on their own, speak for themselves, and they just don't even remotely close come to getting that job done at all. They basically become boilerplate, and they're better than what we had before, so they're an improvement, but they really don't inform the investor in making their decision the way that they could. They fall way short. And so I think you need to, as an investor making that ratification vote, which is another one of the recommendations in the Treasury Committee report, we need to get more out of the audit committees. But then also to make an informed vote, we need some basic information that tells us whether or not, especially as it relates to the firm as well as that particular engagement, we're getting a quality audit. And so we need information to get that either the company or the audit committee needs to turn around and pass on to us. And I don't think just a subjective write-up gets it done. And I think people have to think about what is the information that one needs to be or gain or gather to make an informed decision when we vote, because we want those investors to be making the right type of decisions, but it needs to be an informed one to do that. So we need to make sure we get them that level of information as well. And I do think part of it comes from the company, part of it comes from the audit committee, and part of it will probably have to come from the firm themselves.
Great. Thank you for that. I had one point I'd like to just maybe get some, see if anybody wants to clarify. Some comments were made about the importance of scalability, and some have commented that no notion of scalability was in this particular recommendation. I wondered if either the auditors, the larger firms, or the smaller firms might want to comment as to why scalability here might be, in looking at audit quality, And however it's done, scalability might be an important factor, whether it's the input type of indicators of partner time to staff time, or it's the output kind of indicators of restatements, you know, and sort of things. What are the reasons why scalability might be important or not as we think this through? Galen.
Yeah, and I commented on it earlier. In my example earlier, I mean, there are some very good-sized regional firms and local practices that simply only audit a couple of public companies. 90% of their practice deal with private companies. So when you throw all of the activity, all of the data in that pot, you're talking about their private company, their private practice as opposed to the public company practice, and therefore the statistics really don't mean a heck of a lot. And that's the thing I think that we do need to somehow to think about and address at some point.
Thank you. Liz Gantner?
With regard to scalability, I think it's important because without it, quite frankly, I'm going to win every time as a smaller firm because I'm going to have better partner-to-staff ratios. I'm going to have probably more partner involvement on the engagements. I'm going to have less restatements. I'm not going to have partners that have been censured. I'm not going to have... you know, I can keep going, but I sort of look at this not necessarily that you're protecting me in the mix as you're protecting everybody, because I'm not sure that if audit committees don't know what to ask for, which we've sort of alluded to, that then they can make comparisons between really different entities at their core. So I it's not necessarily to me that the measures are different, but the measures need to be explained and put in context.
Thank you. Vin Coleman?
I actually agree with the context point, but I go back to maybe where Chuck was speaking before, and it was in our breakout group yesterday. And if you think about perhaps the three areas in the selection and approval of an auditor, we kind of summarized it to maybe three areas, and there's many, many factors, as you know. But I think, Chuck, you hit most of them, right? It would be it's the team and the experience of the partner and that team. It's generally deep industry knowledge, but not just when you say industry. It'd be subsector, you know, utilities or, you know, banking or insurance or, you know, that kind of subsector knowledge. And the third is around generally the issues management, those processes around that, and the, you know, the technical capability of the firm. And so I was just going to lay that out for you. So when you're asking about the scalability, when you have critical mass, those disclosures are going to be very, very different. For a firm that's got incredible critical mass, for, you know, so you have, you know, you can select. You know, in utilities, we have 25 partners that only work in utilities. That's all they do. You know, so it's just a different critical mass. It's a different selection. And so I think you just need to think that through and what conclusions people would make as it relates to that, you know, when somebody else has to put out a disclosure that would talk about that, and maybe, you know, it might have unintended consequences. I can't speak for a small firm because we're a big firm, but it just you have to put that into context about where are those big areas, which I think was discussed yesterday.
Well, I want to thank everybody for all the input and valuable time that you put into this discussion around audit quality. I will begin to summarize the points, as they are many and they vary, but... Definitely the quality of the information that we received will help us think through how we'll go ahead with our own deliberations on audit quality indicators and what should be done. So with that, I thank everybody, in particular those who chaired the groups. And Jennifer, are we moving to a break right now?
Yes, we're going to do that. We'll resume in 30 minutes, and we'll discuss at that point signing the auditors or the engagement partner signing the audit report. So according to my watch, it's a little bit after 10:45 we'll resume.